Why isn't my town of Lake Wobegon on any map of Minnesota? Well, back before cartographers had the benefit of the aerial view, when teams of surveyors walked from one town to the next, a lot of mistakes were made. Sometimes those towns were farther apart than they should have been. Many maps were drawn by explorers in the bows of canoes bucking heavy rapids. A worse mistake was made by the Coleman Survey of 1866, which omitted 50 square miles of central Minnesota, including Lake Wobegon. The map was drawn by four teams of surveyors under the direction of Finian Coleman, who put them at the four corners of the state and aimed them towards the middle. The southwest and northwest contingents moved fast because the ground was level, but the eastern teams of surveyors got bogged down in the woods, so when they met a little west of Lake Wobegon, the four maps they drew did not fit within the boundaries legislated by Congress. So the legislature had to reproportion the state by eliminating that overlap in the middle, the little quadrangle that is Mist County. The soil of that region was unsuited to agriculture, so they didn't think that its absence would be noticed very much. What is special about this town of Lake Wobegon? Well, for one thing, the Statue of the Unknown Norwegian. If other towns have one of those, we don't know about it. It was sculpted by a man named O'Connell in 1896, a granite youth who stands in a small plot at a jog in the road where a surveyor knocked off for lunch years ago, and a statue that looks down Main Street toward the lake. A proud figure, his back erect, his feet on the ground, on account of no money remained for a pedestal. And his eyes are interesting. Probably the sculptor meant his eyes to reflect confidence in the new world, but his eyes are set a little deep, so the dark shadows appear in the late afternoon, and by sunset he looks worried. Nevertheless, he is a landmark and an asset, so it was a shame when the tornado of 1947 did damage to him. That tornado skipped in from the northeast. It blew away one house except for a dresser mirror that wasn't even cracked. Amazing. It's in the Historical Society now. People still bring their relatives to look at that mirror. It also picked up a brand new Chevy pickup truck and set it down a quarter mile away on a road in the right-hand lane. In town, it took the roof off the Lutheran church where nobody was, and it missed the Bijou Theater, which was packed with an audience to see the movie Shame, starring Cliff DiCarlo. And it blew a stalk of quack grass about 6 inches into the unknown Norwegian in an unusual place, a place where you wouldn't expect to find grass in a person, a part of the body where you have been told to insert nothing bigger than your finger in a washcloth. Bud, our municipal employee, pulled it out, of course, but the root of that quack grass was embedded in the granite, so it keeps growing out. Bud has thought about using a pre-emergent herbicide on him, but he's afraid it will leave a stain on the side of his head. So when Bud mows, he just reaches up to the unknown Norwegian's right ear and snips off the blade with his fingernails. It's not so noticeable, really. You'd have to look for it to see it. What's special about Lake Wobegon is not special enough to draw a lot of visitors. People who visit Lake Wobegon usually come to see somebody. Otherwise, they probably miss the turn on the highway and are lost. Ausländers, the Germans call them. What's special about here isn't special enough to draw visitors, although Flag Day on June 14th, you could drive a long way to find anything else like it. Flag Day was the idea of a man named Herman Hochstetter, who ran the dry goods store and ran Armistice Day, the 4th of July, and Flag Day, all three celebrations. For the 4th of July, he organized a double-loop parade around the block, which went around twice, and so it allowed people to take turns, marching one time and then standing and watching other people march. On Armistice Day, everyone stepped outside at 11 a.m. and stood in silence for 2 minutes as the church bells tolled 11 times. But Flag Day was Herman's favorite holiday. For a small price, he would install a bracket on your house to hold a pole to hang your flag on, or he would drill a hole in the sidewalk in front of your store with his drill gun. On patriotic days, flags flew all over town. There were flags on the tall poles, flags on the short poles, flags in the brackets on the pillars and the porches, and if you were flagless, you could expect to hear from Herman, who would put his hairy arm around your shoulder, his dog-like face close to yours, and say how proud he was that so many people were proud of their country, leaving you to see the obvious point that you were a gap in the ranks. Back in June 1944, a salesman from Fisher Hat Company called on Herman and offered him a good deal on red and blue baseball caps. "Do you have white also?" Herman asked. The salesman thought that white caps could be had for the same wonderful price, so Herman ordered 200 red, 200 white, and 100 blue. By the end of the year, he still had 486 caps unsold, and so was inspired to organize the first living flag. Put an ad in the paper. "Honor America, June 14 at 4 p.m. Be proud of our land and people. Be part of the living flag. Don't let it be said that Lake Wobegon was too busy. Be on time, 4 p.m. sharp." His wife handed out the caps, and Herman stood on a stepladder and told people where to stand. He lined up the red caps and the white caps into stripes, then got the blue caps into their square up in the corner, and Mr. Hansen climbed up on the roof of the central building, leaned over, and took a photograph. They sang the national anthem, and then the living flag dispersed. The photograph appeared in the paper the next week. Herman kept the caps. People were happy to do as he told them, and to stand in place and to form a flag with the tops of their heads. But in years that followed, dissension cropped up in the ranks of the living flag. People complained about the heat, complained about Herman, what gave him the idea that he could order them around. He had to argue with them, to plead with them, standing on his stepladder. "People, please," he said, "I need your attention. You people in the blue caps, keep your caps on. Stripe number 4, you're starting to sag there in the middle, and you red caps, you're supposed to be up here. Not over there. We got too many white caps. We need more red caps now. Let's do this, please, people, without talking. I can't get you straight. If you keep moving around, some of you are not paying attention to me at all. Now, please, everybody just shut up." One thing that people resented was the fact that none of them ever got to see the living flag that they were a part of. The picture in the paper was always black and white. Only Herman and Mr. Hansen with the camera got to see the real living flag, and some boys who were too short to be a part of it. People wanted a chance to go up to the roof of the central building and to be able to see the living flag for themselves. "How can you go up there if you're supposed to be down here?" Herman said. "You go up there to look, you've got nothing to look at. Isn't enough to know that you're just doing your part and being part of this tribute to our country." But on Flag Day 1949, just as Herman said, "That's it, hold it," one of the red caps made a break for it, dashed up 4 flights of stairs to the roof of the central building and leaned over and had a long look. And even with the hole that he had left behind in the middle of it, it was a magnificent sight. The living flag filling the street below, a perfect flag of brilliant reds and whites and blues. He couldn't take his eyes off it. Herman yelled at him, "Get down here, we need a picture." People yelled up to him, "How does it look?" "Unbelievable, I can't describe it," he said. So then everyone had to go up and have a look. "No, please," Herman said. But they took a vote, and it was unanimous. And one by one, members of the Living Flag went up to the roof and admired this marvelous, marvelous flag. And as the first hour went by, and only 40 of the 500 of them had been to the top and seen it, the others got more and more restless and yelled at the others to hurry up. You've seen it now. Get back down here and give somebody else a chance. People went up in groups of 4 and then 10. But after 2 hours, the Living Flag became the sitting flag and began to erode as the members who had had a look thought about heading home to supper. And people snuck off, and the flag that remained for the last person to see was a flag that looked as if it had been shot by cannon fire. In 1950, the Sons of Canute Lodge took over Flag Day. Herman gave them all the caps. And since then, the Canutes have achieved several good living flags, although most years the attendance was poor. You need at least 400 people to make a good living flag. Some years, the Canutes made a rule, no looking. Other years, they held a lottery to decide who could go up to the roof and look. One year, they experimented with a large mirror held by 2 men over the edge of the roof. But when people in the Living Flag leaned back and looked up to see it, the flag disappeared, of course.